This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGM. Hi, it's John Williams, and happy Monday to you, the day after Valentine's Day. It's President's Day. It's cold outside. We'll keep you abreast of the snow and the cold temperatures and the relief that is coming later in the week. We got to get through today, tonight, and tomorrow. Pete Zimmerman is our producer in promoting the next segment. I think I got it right. Did I say a buyer's market or a seller's market? It is a seller's market. If you are buying, you're going to pay a premium. But I wanted to ask Elise Glink, our first guest this morning, about that. Elise is the real estate and financial wellness expert. Her website is thinkglink.com. Is that going to change anytime soon? Elise, what are you hearing in the midterm on this?
Well, I don't think we're going to see sellers worry too much in the next probably year, John. I think we're going to have a very strong seller's market all through 2021 in most places.
I'm looking at the Mortgage Bankers Association's fourth quarter update. What kind of trends are you seeing there? What's happening?
Well, the good news is that you've got fewer renters and mortgagers, people who have mortgages who are in trouble, but you've got more student loan borrowers who are missing payments. And even so, we know that for federal student loans, those payments are now, you're still in forbearance. But for all the people who have private student loans, more people are starting to miss those payments.
What does that have to do with mortgage bankers?
Well, their mortgage bankers are really focused on, how well people pay mortgages. But if you're missing student loan payments, it doesn't bode well for when you might also be missing your mortgage or your lease payment. And so they're very concerned with the overall numbers that they see coming to them from their customers, their member banks, who do all of these different kinds of loans.
My understanding is those that were participating in forbearance would not have the missed payments counted. It would not be a missed payment. Do you understand that too?
Yes, that's true. So if you're in the official mortgage forbearance program, and about a little less than 3 million people are still in that, it's about 5.5% of all people who have mortgages right now. If you went into a forbearance program, that's not a negative on your credit. It wasn't anything. And that program is still available. But there are a lot of people who didn't go into that program, or for one reason or another, like they're not with a federal student, federally backed lender like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or VA, FHA, USDA. If you had a different mortgage lender, you might not have been eligible for a forbearance program. And those are the people who are falling behind.
I'm seeing here that student debt borrowers, those with student loans, 15% of them missed one mortgage payment. But I guess that underscores the point, if I'm reading this correctly, that if you're having trouble making your student loan payments, you're also a mortgage risk. And 15%, what's that? A little over 1 in 6 have missed a payment in the last three quarters, sometime last year.
Yeah, if you look at the number of student debt borrowers who missed payments, it's almost 27 million people, right? And what's interesting about that number, John, is that so many people had just simply stopped paying their student loans before COVID hit anyway. They had, particularly younger borrowers, there was a trend line showing that people were just unable to keep up with these enormous debt payments. And even if they were getting jobs, because remember, a year ago, we had the very lowest unemployment I think we'd ever had in history, right? And still a huge number of student loan borrowers were missing payments. Well, that's, now increased. So if you look at the number of who are missing payments, that number is going up dramatically. And about, 42.5% of all borrowers. And that's a real concern for all of us. Now, this was in December when we started to see the numbers of people employed roll back. Remember, we saw that dip, and that's why there's been such a push in January and February to get a new round of stimulus out there.
What about laws to prevent landlords, or I guess whoever holds a mortgage, from evicting people because they can't make their rent or can't make their mortgage payment? What is the status of that, Elise?
So, again, we've seen on loans that let's break it out just a little bit so everybody can keep up at home. You know, when a landlord actually has a property that's backed by a federal loan, right? So some of these small buildings that may have only 4 to 6 units in them, oftentimes that those will be backed by a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan, which is still in conservatorship, so it's considered a government-backed program. When you've got a government-backed loan, there has been a moratorium in place, both for eviction for your tenants, but also for you for having your building, if you're not making your payments, to go into foreclosure. But what we're seeing is that across the country, in addition to these federal moratoriums, there are also state and local moratoriums on evictions. And yet, even so, we're still seeing people get evicted. And in fact, a lot of renters don't even know that this is in place. And mm-hmm. so when their landlord comes to them to toss them, millions are still feeling like they're at risk of being forced out in the next 30 days.
I can understand how it's hard to keep up if you're the renter or the rentee, the mortgage holder or the mortgagee. I also wanted to ask you a little bit about Zillow and what you're seeing in terms of neighborhoods, states, communities, prices. Let's pick that up here in just a minute. Elise Glink, real estate and financial wellness expert on the Wintrust Business Lunch. WGN Elise Glink. ThinkGlink.com is her website. She's the real estate and financial wellness expert. Joins us Mondays on the Wintrust Business Lunch. What's the Zillow report say? How are neighborhood states, how are homes moving?
Well, they're moving very well nationally, which is good to see, actually. And even though, you know, the path forward with the economy is a little uncertain is one way to put it, I would say a little bit forward, backward, kind of fluctuating. Confidence in the housing market is really strong. We're seeing across the board new homes getting just sucked up, really, by the marketplace. According to Redfin's report yesterday, something like north of 60% of all homes that go in the market are getting multiple bid offers. And we're seeing that in places around the Chicago metropolitan area as well, which is good to see.
60%?
Yep, 60%. There's simply, this is a seller's market, as you pointed out right at the top of the segment, John. Not enough homes available to be sold right now.
Well, I don't know what it typically is. Do you? I mean, how often does somebody get, you're saying more than half of the homes that go up for sale have more than one offer, which I assume means it's going to be close to ask, you know, two people pushing it up. I wonder what it is typically, multiple offers.
It's very low, actually. So in a normal market, what brokers would call a normal market, where there's roughly a 6-month supply of homes for sale, right now you're looking at under 2 months, and in many markets, under a month's supply. So what that means is if you didn't add any more homes for sale, even though we're in the spring market now and more homes are being added, but if you didn't, let's just take that off the table, and nothing's being added. What would happen is within a month, there'd be zero homes for sale. So that's the kind of speed that we're seeing in the marketplace. And, you know, again, single family houses in suburban areas with great school districts are going faster than condos that need work in the city, for example, right now. But yeah. Overall, nationally and even here in Chicago, we're seeing homes get sold at an extremely quick pace.
I'm trying to remember now. Prior to the last housing bubble, wasn't there a lot of flipping going on? It just seemed like such an easy way to make money. You buy a house for $100,000 and you put $50,000 in and then you sell it for $200,000. Since it seems like home values are going up so quickly, is any of that going on? Are you hearing about people just investing in properties and turning them?
Well, we see a lot of people fighting for that, right? There's a company called Homevestors, and they have those yellow signs that say, "We buy ugly homes." And they're actually in the business of doing that. And nationwide, they say that their business is very strong. They've got investors who own anywhere from, you know, 10 to 400 homes. And what they do is they look around for those homes to either flip them or to rent them out. And there are a lot of other people who are in the market to do that as well. The problem is that the prices are going up so quickly, and so many people are looking to literally move into those homes, that I think this is part of the reason you're seeing these pricing bidding
wars,
start to heat up.
because I don't hear it as much as I used to. And maybe it's people are scrambling for these properties, not to sell them to somebody else, but to move in themselves. David Hochberg, right, on his show, Home Sweet Home Chicago, Saturdays here on WGN, was talking about how that's also pushing the cost of supplies, building materials, lumber and things like that are escalating. And so new home or fixing up a home, it's more expensive than it might otherwise have been. I suppose you're hearing something like that too.
Oh, he's absolutely right about that. The cost of lumber is skyrocketing. And it's in short supply, which is even worse, right? Because you need houses to build a house or renovate a house, right? You need lumber typically. And it's just getting very hard to get your hands on it. Compounding that problem is because there's so many people now trying to fix up their homes because they're staying in them,
mm-hmm,
and they need to remake them or redo them, or they want them to look like Pinterest, who knows. But all of that is meaning that there's also a shortage of the number of people who are working in the building trades. A lot of times we see people who come in from other countries, particularly, you know, Eastern Europe, or we may see it from Latin America, who have specialties in plastering or in woodwork or, you know, in home building trades. And they often come in and that's, you know, the place where they find work and they get in. But we've cut back on the number of people who are coming in. And a lot of people who were, you know, in the U.S. 10 years ago in the home building trade, when that market fell apart with the housing crisis, they left the industry and have not come back. And so we are seeing the number of people rise who are going into the construction trades. But between that and the shortage of lumber and the shortage of wallboard and other things that you need to build houses, it's really constraining the amount of supply.
Two more questions for you, Elise. One is about refinancing. Is this a good time to take it out and remodel the equity in your home? The other thing is, do you wonder or worry about what this will say about home prices 10 years from now, 5 years from now? I mean, this can't last. I wonder if there's not going to be a market correction. People who are paying over ask right now, maybe not upside down, but might not have all the equity they think they would have in 5 years.
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question, right? Are we headed for, is this 2006, 2005, 2006, and are we heading for another big meltdown in foreclosure? I have to say, the good news is I don't think that's where we are right now. And the reason I don't think that is because the percentage of Americans who are underwater with their home overall nationally is extremely low right now. Home prices have been rising so quickly that everybody is more or less right side up. Chicago, sadly, though, is still at the low end of that. So what we're seeing in the Chicago area is that certain neighborhoods haven't risen in value. And you can see this in different local papers where they'll publish, like, so-and-so is selling his house for a $600,000 loss, which I think is one of our football players who's selling, maybe.
Yeah.
And so you see those kinds of stories in Chicago happening more than else, you know, in other places. On the other hand, what you are seeing is that for the first time in about 10 years, the North Shore, western suburbs, northern suburbs are seeing prices increase to a place where people aren't underwater anymore. And they've had 10 more years to pay down those mortgages at ultra-low interest rates, and that's helping too. I think the thing to really watch out for, John, is what happens when interest rates pop up a little bit. Now, we haven't seen interest rates over 6% except for like 2 months since 1993. That's a really long time ago, 25 years or 26 years, 27 years. I don't know. A long time.
Yeah.
So I don't see us having interest rates go up. But when you're buying at the very top of your range and interest rates are 2.5% or 3%, even popping up to 4%, could put downward pressure on the prices. So that, to me, is the thing to watch out for, not a huge foreclosure problem.
I got it. I had to laugh. I was listening to Lou Manfredini on Saturday as well, and he played an audio clip. He didn't say who the comic was, but the guy was a young man on stage, a comic, and he said, you know, I hate you older people who say, well, my house is now valued at $700,000, but in 1973 I paid 6 raspberries for it, and now I have all of this equity, and it's just so fantastic. And that's not a guarantee, and sometimes it's just good luck and timing for you. It's a very funny clip, Lou. You got to tell me where you got that. But refi, what's your advice to people that are thinking about, now that their home's elevated value, taking some money out?
You know, I think that that's not a bad idea, but I'm a little bit more conservative, John. You know, unless you have a place to put the money, and please don't tell me it's Robinhood and you're going to be investing in GameStop, right? That's not a reason to take cash out. But if you are looking to buy a vacation home somewhere else, or you want to buy an investment property, or you're looking to make a, you know, pay for college tuition, and this is a, you know, a way to do it, there are lots of different ways to finance different things that you want to do. This is one way to do it, but I'd be very cautious about it. The delinquency rate for Illinois is actually about 7.6%. We're higher than, you know, most of what's going on in the country. So I'd really like to see people be really conservative with their money until we get a better sense of where we're going and what your income prospects look like for the next 3 to 5 years.
Lisa's book is 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask. ThinkLink.com. Okay, Lisa, nice to talk to you. We'll visit next Monday.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGM. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. I'm John Williams. Our next guest is chef and partner Michael Bonner. You know him from Serenello's, Di Pescara, Pettorino's, The Ivy Room. There is an event coming up in cooperation with the folks at Let Us Entertain You to, I think, show you and I how to get Southern cooking right, if I'm not mistaken. Michael, thanks for joining us. You're on WGN. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me this morning. It's a pleasure to talk to you and give you some insight on what we're going to be doing.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you betcha. Do tell. Expand on that. It's an online virtual cooking demonstration, right?
Yeah, it's an online virtual cooking demonstration. I'm working with a chef by the name of Lulu, and she owns and operates a small container in Boxville, just, you know, on 51st Street, on next to the Green Line. And she's going to be showing me how to, you know, make one of my favorite dishes, which is roast chicken, more West Africanized flavors, and just a great opportunity for me to learn more about that type of cuisine. But it also brings some exposure to what she's doing there at Hoverbox in Bronzeville.
So she's going to show you, I'm going to watch, and then I'm going to learn how to cook this kind of food, too. I presume it's rubs and spices, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. You know, honestly, you know, roast chicken is like one of my favorite dish. It's like a dish that I grew up eating. And, you know, we were trying to think about how we can make this, you know, more enlightening, more exciting. And it does include rubs. It also has like a classic halal rice, jollof rice, which is, you know, seasoned rice that has like some spice to it. It's got some curry in it. And the two combinations of both the rice and the chicken is a collaboration of both of us, you know, cooking food that reminded us growing up in our homes in celebration of African American cuisine for Black History Month.
Suppose you chef types really love the fusion, right? Like you've got that culture, I've got this culture, you're from there, I'm from here. How can we blend the flavors and make something unique without completely compromising the history of these foods as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. The other part of it is just, you know, learning through food. You know, there's a lot of history of like how food is transformed in Black culture in this country. And I think that a lot of, and I'm, you know, I've been cooking professionally for almost 35 years now, and I don't know a lot about, you know, West African cuisine. So it was, I'm real curious about just understanding how it works and, you know, how do you make flavors work with, from that perspective. So it's enlightening for me. And I think that we put together a great meal that people will enjoy.
Let Us Entertain You, I know, is trying to spread the wealth, help some of the neighborhoods and some of the restaurants in those neighborhoods. So we're talking about Bronzeville now, celebrating Black History Month with this special virtual event. It brings together the history and flavors of Black and African-American cuisines. And it's a historically Black neighborhood on Chicago's South Side, Bronzeville. The restaurant you're talking about is located in Bronzeville?
Yeah, so this is a really unique opportunity because, you know, there is a program that's called Urban Juncture. And what they do is try to provide opportunities for, you know, Black and African-American restaurant, you know, entrepreneurs who are looking for an opportunity to, you know, start up their own restaurant business. So they operate out of these small boxes in this little, you know, community is called Boxville. And it gives, you know, these folks an opportunity to kind of incubate. We call it a culinary incubator. And they, you know, are mentored about how to run a business, how to, you know, procure food and just how to set up a restaurant in hopes that they can eventually move out of Boxville and into a brick and mortar restaurant. And we at Lettuce are excited to partner with them and share some of our expertise with some of these hopeful restaurant entrepreneurs to give them insight on how it's done.
Yeah. Do you know, have restaurants on the South Side struggled more or less or the same as everybody else since last March?
I think that, you know, from what I've heard, I mean, we're all in the same boat as far as, you know, dine-in customers. You know, what's interesting is that the restaurants that are on the South Side are uniquely, you know, they were uniquely prepared for how pivoting from dine-in customers to carry out and delivery. A lot of the restaurants, as you know, that are on the South Side are, you know, carry out and pick up only anyways to begin with. So I think that they have. I think that, you know, so I, you know, from what I've heard, that they've really just picked up more opportunities and carry out and delivery.
I was at Nordstrom the other day, and there was a couple of ladies that when you walked in had their desserts on display for Valentine's Day. Pick up sweet treats for your sweetheart. And they had a caramel salt iced cake. And I couldn't resist it. So I got some of that and their velvet cake and their chocolate cake. But caramel cake is a Southern dish too, right?
Absolutely. Just, you know, that the flavors of, you know, well, and that's one of the features of the dish, of the meal that we're preparing. Salt, caramel, brown sugar, caramelized to this, you know, confection is delicious. It, just hearing you talk about it, you know, the flavors came to my mind of growing up eating that. So, absolutely.
Yeah, I walked in and said, this isn't even fair. You can't be doing this. I mean, you see that. And it was a nice, generous layer of the icing on top of some just really rich, dense-looking pound cake. And I was like, okay, oh, yes, I'm buying that. I didn't know, you know, what does it cost? And she rang it up and told me, after I'd agreed to buy it, if she had said it was $4,000, I would have said, fair enough. It seems right. Seems about right. Okay, so if I want to watch this then, if I want to watch you guys cook and learn as I go, where do I go? How do I do that?
Well, the first off, it is a free event. We're offering the actual cooking demonstration via Talk. And you can go online to Talk Events and search out the event with virtual event collaborating Black cuisine through culinary collaboration, a mouthful to say. And then also we are offering folks the opportunity to pick up a meal kit through Ivy Room, and that's going to be available on Friday, the 19th of February, and that's 12 East Ohio Street. And you can do all this online and that Talk web address that I've given you. You can also learn more about Urban Juncture at urbanjuncture.com, and it speaks specifically about their mission and what they're trying to do with working with young restaurant entrepreneurs and trying to get that urban collaboration off the ground.
What a great idea. Michael Bonner. Okay, I'll repeat it again later in the show in case you didn't catch all of that, but the Let Us Entertain You site has it, leye.com, as in Let Us Entertain You, events.com, leye.com. And you can also check out urbanjuncture.com and cook along. Nice to talk to you, Michael. Well done. We'll be watching.
Thank you. Thank you for having me in the show. Have a great day.
And eating. It's 12:43 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. The business news continues now. Let's check on Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Southwest Airlines is now offering service from O'Hare Airport. The airline started nonstop flights yesterday to Baltimore, Dallas, Denver, Nashville, and Phoenix. Starting March 13th, Southwest will also offer Saturday-only service to Orlando. The airline has already operated from Midway Airport since 1985. Midway will remain its primary airport for now. Southwest offers up to 200 flights a day from Midway. Chicago startup Jornera has launched a new product to help travel companies know when their customers are planning to travel again. Chicago Inno reports the product is called Journey Aware and will give companies data showing when a customer is about to book travel. It helps hotels connect with customers shortly after they've booked air travel, for example. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Right now we get to Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. One of the places that I remember very fondly eating and would still go to is Steak and Shake. I see a troubling headline here, Amy. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. So Steak and Shake is considering bankruptcy, a bankruptcy filing to manage their debt right now. And I think this is something we're going to start seeing as we move through the, you know, as we get towards the, hopefully, the light at the end of the tunnel with the pandemic. Although we're not out of the woods yet, I think the stress of the last year really showed a lot of, exacerbated a lot of issues for a lot of companies, and Steak and Shake certainly one of them. And of course, they were originally founded downstate in Illinois, so that's one we keep an eye on here because it's here in our own backyard. But you know, looking at managing their debt load and everything that's transpired in the last year, it's really looking as like an option for them as one way to go in order to manage that debt. So that doesn't necessarily mean that they would close their doors. It would just be a way to manage that debt, but it could mean some changes depending on who steps in. To help them deal with that, to help them manage that and manage their way out of it. That can always mean changes for the companies. We've seen that happen to many, many companies. So that's something we're definitely keeping an eye on today.
Have you eaten there before?
I've actually never eaten at a Steak and Shake.
Well, it might not be your cup of tea, but they grill those hamburgers on a big flat skillet, you know, just one of those great big cooking surfaces, and they really press down on them. So it's kind of a thin burger. Maybe you'll get a couple of them with cheese and then a bun or a patty melt, which was awesome. They had very thin fries, a decent salad, and you'd get this awesome chocolate shake with the thing. Maybe the, you know, appetite for people these days isn't for that kind of food, but it was really good. And to me, it's a sign. I think that kind of food is still viable. To me, it is a sign that it's not just, is your product good enough to weather this storm? There are other factors. I mean, Steak and Shake should survive. Steak and Shake should come back. But if it doesn't, I'll feel really sad because I think they had a good product.
Yeah, and I think what the type of filing they're looking at wouldn't necessarily mean to liquidate and close down, but probably more likely to just help manage the debt so they could keep moving forward. So that could mean no changes at all. So consumers could notice absolutely zero changes. Everything is normal. Burgers taste the same. Fries are still the same. Everything is exactly the same. But it might also mean some changes. So we're going to watch that really closely and see what happens in the months ahead.
Vegan chocolate, is that on our horizon too?
Yeah, potentially. So Nestle has been, you know, as the conversation around plant-based products has been increasing recently, Nestle has been experimenting with a vegan option for condensed milk, and it's kind of a rice-based thing. They've been testing with that. It's available in some parts of Europe, and now with what they know, they're going to test a vegan Kit Kat. For now, it's just in Europe, but if it goes well, we will see that here in the U.S., using it's rice-based, which is usually, you know, we're talking soy-based, things like that. But as a lot of people identify soy as an allergen or something they want to avoid, more of these plant-based meat makers and other plant-based snack makers have been trying to look around for other options besides soy. So this would be a rice-based vegan Kit Kat. So we'll see about that. I don't know if you've ever seen, there are so many, if you just around the world, so many different kinds of Kit Kat. I was kind of surprised there wasn't a vegan one already because there's, you know, savory flavors, especially in the Asian markets. There's hundreds of flavors of Kit Kat. So I'm surprised it took them this long to get to it. But that is what Nestle is working on right now.
Well, a chocolate snack is not going to go vegan because of the chocolate. It's because of the milk in it, right? That's what we're talking about?
Well, it could be a couple of things. There can be some dairy products in, like if there's a caramel binder, there could be, if it's milk chocolate in the chocolate versus like a dark chocolate that's dairy-free. There's a couple of different pieces. But I think that that milk piece is a big part of a lot of candy making, and so that's where they're looking for this.
Okay, talk to me about, there was one other food one that was on my mind. Well, I guess it's this French hotel, which is vaguely food centric, but
yeah.
Google fined $1 million for a misleading ranking, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think this is a really compelling story because European courts, particularly French and Irish courts, have treated tech giants vastly differently than they have been treated in the U.S. So I'm always very interested to see what that conversation is and what's happening. So the latest is that Google essentially was using their own algorithm to assign stars on hotels. So if you're searching for a hotel in France and you see, oh, it's 5-star, seems like a good price, I'm going to book that. France has its own body, its own kind of regulating authority to assign stars so that it is a very streamlined and regulated process. Those two different things, Google's version and France's version, were vastly different. And so this went to court and it was found that that Google had misled people. And so they've agreed to pay a fine of 1.1 million euros. That's about 1.3 million US because of this, because the court found that they had misled people in their hotel booking. Irish courts are watching this, of course, very carefully. They've already been a little bit of movement in this space with Irish courts for this exact same reason, because if you have a government body that regulates hotels, That algorithm from Google is based on user reviews around activity, things like that, whereas France has these, you know, very specific standards. So that is going to get, they're now going to show a different display starting very soon. You will see a different display if you Google French hotels than you did before. It won't be the same Google stars. It'll be the French official ranking.
Well, I guess I appreciate that. It's no one is suggesting that they tweak the algorithm to make more money for themselves or anything like that. It was just they were using a system different than the one the French are used to. Okay, it reminds me a little bit about the fuss about champagne. You can't say it's champagne unless the grapes are from Champagne. You can't say it's a 5-star French hotel unless it's their system. Google wasn't sort of concocting a scheme here, right?
Yeah, that's not necessarily what the court was saying, just that the word they did use, though, was misleading. They said they misled consumers based on their algorithm. What doesn't mean that they were necessarily doing it to try to make money or take money out of French hotels, but that they were using a different system while people perhaps believed. And I think part of that is about transparency. They were using a different system, and that wasn't clear to people who were booking that hotel that it wasn't the same rating system used by the French governing authority.
A tech giant not being transparent. I'm shocked, I say. Talk to me about what happened in Texas and the power grid down there.
Yeah, well, you know, this is my home state. So I was, of course, keeping an eye on this and checking in with some family members about it, of whether or not they had power. Some of them did not. So as this major storm went through Texas, and for the first time ever, every county in Texas was under some kind of winter advisory, which was kind of unheard of. And here's people seeing snow sometimes for the first time in their lives. But what it's done is the power grid system in Texas is very, very different than it is here, where you kind of don't really have a choice. You kind of have a monopoly of, if you move to this area, this is the utility company you use. It's a very different and very competitive system. And we're seeing that really put to the test right now in Texas as rolling blackouts started pretty much right away as the power grid was really being stressed. Then we started to see these rolling blackouts stretching much longer. What was supposed to be 15, 30 minutes were going into much longer reports of much longer blackouts. The other thing I'm keeping an eye on, though, is that wholesale electricity prices, because the system is a bit different, on Monday, they surpassed the grid's price gap of $9,000 per megawatt hour. So the average prices is $25 per megawatt hour on the Texas grid. And we're getting up there in $9,000. What had previously been kind of the record was during the heat wave of 2019, those really stressed. And here we have, it has just kind of blown all those records and changed all that right now. So there's an economic piece that I'm watching very closely today.
Oh, interesting. You normally think about that in a warm weather thing, but I guess with the power lines down, it's a cold weather thing too. And we are out of time. Okay, well done. Nice to talk to you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch.